I was sitting at June's kitchen table. I will call her June to protect her identity, but this is not her real name. She is Native American, Ojibwe, from northern Minnesota. The autumn was upon us, and two buckets of apples were waiting to be turned into applesauce. This remarkable woman, June, now in her 60s, raised 6 children off the land. And when I asked her about how she did it, she started telling me about the ways in which they always kept enough wild rice to get through the winter, how they looked forward to the maple syrup season in early spring. But suddenly, seamlessly, as if it was connected in her mind, she slid into enumerating the ways in which she had experienced violence, abuse, losses of loved ones, one hardship after another. And I wondered about why memories of gathering food brought her to tell me these stories. I met June several years before this podcast project, but through her I began to understand the ways in which Indigenous food memories are braided in with experiences of systemic violence against women, as well as against people who identify to be non-binary. With a smile and incredible humor, June got up and began to peel those apples. "Food is where the healing begins," she says, "and our land has all the medicine we need." This is the second episode of a mini podcast series called A Journey Through Feminist Agroecology. My name is Jessica Milgram from the Agroecology Now group at the Center for Agroecology, Water, and Resilience at the University of Coventry in the UK. This podcast series is a collaboration with CIDSA, the International Network of Catholic Social Justice Organizations. In this episode, we will explore food sovereignty and Indigenous feminism in the context of North America. My colleague Tilla Kiss and I interviewed 3 amazing women. First, we will hear from Lisa Ironcloud, who shares about the art of butchering buffalo and her personal journey of reconnection with Indigenous foods. Priscilla Setti provides some historical background on colonial violence against food and women. Finally, Simone Senegals talks to us about the complexity of feminism in Indigenous food sovereignty movements. But wait, why are we talking about food sovereignty on a podcast mini-series on agroecology? Both food sovereignty and agroecology are social movements that strive to build food systems that are ecologically and socially just. And there are other movements out there, too, working towards similar goals. There are some differences, but we believe that the lessons learned from feminisms and Indigenous food sovereignty movements are valuable to other contexts around the world and to building our understanding of feminist agroecology in practice. Before jumping in, just a couple of clarifications. Food sovereignty has been defined as the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and their right to define their own food and agricultural systems. But for Indigenous people, food sovereignty can have a different feel to it. First, relationships and responsibility, rather than rights, lie at the heart of Indigenous food sovereignty. Indigenous food sovereignty specifically includes fishing, hunting, and gathering as the basis for many Indigenous foodways, rather than only focusing on agriculture. Indigenous food sovereignty is also a decolonial project of reparations and reconstruction. We'll hear more about that on this episode. Our first guest is Lisa Ironcloud. Lisa teaches people to butcher buffalo. Lisa shared her powerful journey of self-discovery and reconnection through returning to her ancestral foodways.
My name is Lisa Water Ironcloud. Water is my maiden name. My parents are Albert and Agnes. My dad is from Pine Ridge, the reservation in South Dakota. It's also called Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And my mom's from Manderson, South Dakota, which is also on the Pine Ridge Reservation. So I am enrolled Oglala Lakota.
The Oglala is one of the 7 sub-tribes of the Lakota people. Most Oglala Lakota today live in South Dakota. Like many Lakota people of her generation, Lisa's relationship with traditional foods was not given to her from birth.
I grew up mainly in Rapid City, is where I live now. I grew up mainly here, both on and off the reservation, but the majority of my life was spent here in Rapid City. Whenever I was growing up, we struggled a lot. We were homeless a lot of times. We were what they referred to as motel kids. So we grew up like that, very erratic, you know, not for sure where we're going to be, you know, a lot of times. So for me and my family, our priority was surviving. And a lot of times in the city, especially, we really didn't grow up harvesting a lot of our foods. So a lot of our diet came from the grocery store. Everything that we ate came from the grocery store. And a lot of times, because of our financial status, it was always the most cheapest food that they could buy, which consisted of hot dogs and potato chips and really cheap soda. So that's how I grew up. So the majority of my life, that's what we ate. You know, that's what food was to us.
Then, 10 years ago, Lisa joined a sewing group.
It wasn't until 2012 we started a sewing circle in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. And the intention behind that was so that I would be able to learn how to sew. And it worked. So I was able to get women together to come sew. And we did a potluck then. And after a while, it became more eating. So we were thinking, you know, it has to be better than this, you know, our food selection. Because a lot of times it was like really heavy foods, like heavy in sugar and flour. And it sparked up a conversation about our traditional foods. Because the majority of the people that came to the sewing circle were older women, older Lakota women. So we would have conversations of like their past, their experiences, you know, what it was like when they were growing up. And that's what led to the food. They were remembering eating certain types of foods. So it really sparked my interest because I remember growing up and seeing inside of my maternal grandmother's house, like sticks hanging from the ceiling. And on them, she dried her food.
In pre-colonial times, her people lived off the land. They were semi-nomadic, depended on the buffalo, foraging, and some gardening. Lisa's grandmother had learned many of these ways when she was a child, even though she grew up on the reservation. But she didn't pass on the knowledge she had to her grandchildren out of fear. Traditional practices were still shunned.
So everything that we received was what we took from the land. So the thought was like, we care for the land and it provides for us too. You know, that's been lost. I would say even a little before pre-reservation, you can tell when that way of life was ending, how everything got really shaky, really unstable, because they were forced to stop living a life that they understood. And to be confined, to not even speak our language or go out and harvest our foods. Because the thing with us was that if somebody went out to go get foods, they were killed. And they were scalped. So their scalps were sold or the body was sold. So it's like, do you feed your family? Go out and, you know, try to find food to feed your family. Knowing that you'll probably never come back. You know, a lot of situations like that, you know, where it was life and death and our food used against us and being stripped from us and then replaced with their type of food, which only led to, you know, a lot of sickness for us because it was a lot of things that we weren't familiar with.
The U.S. government moved Native Americans onto reservations, cut them off from their sources of food, and provided them with food rations, what they called commodities. Canned meat, canned fruit and syrup, white flour, sugar. Today, this is widely recognized as the cause of health problems for many Native Americans. Elders, however, continued to harvest the foods and medicines that they could. Lisa's grandmother, for example. Lisa remembered her grandmother's house, the sticks used for drying food, and the smell of herbs. And she started asking questions.
It's like this caught my attention, you know, and I became less interested in the sewing circle because I wanted to find out more about our foods. Not understanding, because now I understand, but not understanding at that time that I was going to also find myself in that process. Because, like I said, I grew up very poor, where priority was surviving. You know, so there was no time to find out who I was. You know, it was all about making money and keeping our head above water as much as we could. So understanding what it meant to be Lakota, understanding what it meant to be a female, was nothing that was really, you know, talked with us about.
So Lisa left the sewing circle and started reconstructing all the knowledge about her traditional foods that she could find.
I talked to my cousin, and my cousin's a little older than me. She's in her 60s. So I remembered she would prepare foods like that, and I started asking her about it. And she said, I could show you. So I said, okay. And I said, what do I need to get? And she told me, get a couple roasts from the store. We'll start from there. So I was like, all right. So that's what we did. She was showing me how to thinly cut the meat. She taught me how to thinly cut the meat. And it was really frustrating at first because it felt like my meat kept coming out in chunks. And it wasn't coming out in sheets like hers. That's whenever I started, you know, thinking to myself, well, I have to be kinder to myself because I was never taught this, you know, so I wouldn't give up right away.
Together, Lisa and her cousin began to reconstruct methods of food preparation and conservation based on fragments of memories.
If she didn't know how to prepare it, but she went through memory, we would go through her memories and she would tell me what she remembered, like the texture of it or how it would taste. And we would figure it out from there.
This became an important personal journey in which she started asking herself questions about why she is expected to act in a certain way as a woman and what it means to be Lakota.
Because it started from that, from the butcherings into the plants into, okay, so who am I? You know, they say, okay, I'm Lakota, I'm enrolled in Lakota, and I'm a woman. But what does that mean? What does that really mean? And I would come across people, well, you know, you're a woman, so you have to take care of the home and you have to do this and do that. Oh, okay. You know, really trying to make sense of it. But as I journeyed on and started becoming closer with the plants, closer with our food, understanding why they prepared foods in certain ways, to me, it was like, wait a minute. And I started questioning a lot of these, I guess, what would it be called? Like how our roles as a woman and what they say a woman should be. It didn't make any sense to me after a while. I feel like I'm better able to parent my daughter because of it. You know, because I think that I would have never questioned a lot of things that were pretty present in my life where men were held above women. You know, boys were a lot higher than women. You know, they were tended to, where the females were really treated rough and expected to, you know, be okay all the time with the way they were treated, you know, and be more of a servant, I guess. And, you know, not complain about it.
More questions would come for Lisa when she put her quest into practice. She started to extend her learning journey to others in her community. She decided she wanted to hold butchering classes to teach other people what she had learned.
When I started becoming more involved in the food and sharing what I was learning with others, I started understanding that a lot of these expectations that they had on females, a lot of it was influenced by the church. That the women, they always say that our tribe was a matriarchal society, but they didn't practice it. You know, it was said, but it wasn't really practiced.
Despite the fact that traditionally butchering buffalo is work done by both women and men, Lisa has faced many challenges as a woman recovering this practice.
When I would teach classes and I would get up there, nobody would listen to me. It was almost like I didn't know what I was talking about. But my husband would get up there and they soaked in everything he said. And a lot of times what my husband was saying was what I was saying, and he was just repeating it. Because, I mean, even when we started doing the buffalo butcherings, they would say, Arlo Ironcloud, who's my husband, Arlo Ironcloud started these butchering classes, you know, to teach people how to butcher. And he's sitting there saying, you know, I really don't care about this stuff, you know.
For many Native American tribes, the buffalo was one of the most important sources of food, tools, clothing. They used every part of the animal for something. Between 1872 and 1873, the U.S. government started systematically killing all the buffalo that they could find to starve the Native Americans into submission. They killed more than 3 million buffalo in 1 year under the motto, "Every buffalo dead is an Indian gone." So in 1890, once the buffalo were practically extinct, Thomas J. Morgan, the Indian commissioner at that time, was in charge of assimilating natives into a Euro-American way of life. He had created these rules for what were called Indian agents to enforce. Women and children were removed from the butchering process as a part of the colonial attempt to separate people from their traditional foods.
Whenever the natives were issued rations, they were given cow. And they didn't really take to cow very much. So they tried to figure out ways to get them to be able to take this cow. So they were allowing them to mimic the hunts so that they would be more willing to eat it because they hunted it. And after a while, they wanted to remove women and children from that butchering process. So before, they were very much a part of it. But in 1890, when they started enforcing these rules, women and children were kept away from that butchering process. And they weren't allowed to eat the intestines or the stomach. And they weren't allowed to consume the blood either because it was savage, so they say. So women weren't allowed to touch the meat either, only the men. So they really removed women and children from that process. And it took them about 4 years before, I guess, they were successful.
So for Lisa, butchering buffalo became like reclaiming a place in society that had been lost. Learning how colonization had removed women from this vital practice helped her.
You know, being able to understand, okay, so this is where this happened, kind of allowed me to be able to figure out how far back I needed to go, you know, to be able to start understanding, you know, how our relationship with our food was severed too, you know, and being able to work forward from that and trying to reconnect people through the way I've been reconnecting, because I don't know any other way, but to be able to help people, women especially, to reconnect to our foods, because a lot of times women are told, this is what you do and that's how you do it. And a lot of times it's by a man. So men who are not women, who will never be women, are telling women how to be, telling females how to be. So it allowed me to be able to question that and say, okay, so this is what happened. This is how we are now. How are we going to fix this? Because to me, it's broken because we were removed from that, all of it, women, that we have to find our own way of connecting, reconnecting, and taking it back.
For this reason, Lisa seeks to bring this knowledge and experience, especially to women and youth. Her goal is to teach women to be able to butcher without any fear of being put down.
So whenever we teach, we always try to teach the women first, then the youth. So we do a lot of youth buffalo harvest at the schools. But to allow the women that confidence to be able to go out and do her own butchering, you know, without any fear of a man coming in and telling her she doesn't know what the heck she's doing.
It became clear to her that her job was to reconnect people, especially women, to traditional foods. It was like an avenue for getting back to self, like finding your belly button and tracing it back to the mother.
We really disconnected from our foods, which is to me really interesting because my experience with food is so powerful. I feel like if somebody's searching for, in Lakota, they'll say you're looking for your belly button, like you're unsure, you know? I feel like our food is our belly button because things start to make sense whenever we get back into it and we live it. I think we can start understanding, you know, where like a lot of those teachings and stuff, we become disconnected from it, which also kind of disconnected us from everything else. And I started to understand that, you know, everybody has a connection. Whether they realize it or not, they have a connection.
Burning of crops and killing of the buffalo, for example, were tools of conquest. But even after treaties were signed and the land taken over by colonial governments, moving people onto reservations cut them off from their traditional foods. And later, restrictive policies undermined Indigenous people's success in farming. Priscilla Setti, a longtime scholar and activist on Indigenous food systems, helped us to understand the historical legacy behind the discrimination, the intersectional violence that Indigenous women face today.
My name is Dr. Priscilla Setti, and I originate from Cumberland House First Nations in northern Saskatchewan, and I'm Swampy Cree, and I'm Professor Emerita of Indigenous Studies, and I am currently the new acting vice dean Indigenous for our College of Arts and Science here at the University of Saskatchewan.
Intersectional violence refers to the experience of discrimination and violence that women or non-binary or Two-Spirit people face, especially if they are Indigenous, Black or brown-skinned, economically disadvantaged, or culturally not mainstream white. It's like where all the discrimination converges. Two-spirit people identify as having both a masculine and feminine spirit. The term is used by some Indigenous people to describe their sexual gender and or spiritual identity.
The colonizers understood the strength of women, and so they purposely went in to undermine that. The women headed structures and the family, and nothing was more destructive than those two acts alone. Destroying the family, breaking up communities, and brutalizing Indigenous women. And so that is a really powerful legacy that we are still deconstructing.
Destruction of Indigenous food systems and of Indigenous women were two powerful weapons used by colonists to conquer the continent. Priscilla describes in her book, The Strength of Women, the multiple ways women have disproportionately suffered under colonization from physical, emotional, sexual violence, and forced sterilization, for example. Today, there are other data that point to the persistence of this intersectional violence suffered by Indigenous relatives. Murder is the third leading cause of death among Native women and girls aged 10 to 24. According to a study from 2016 in Canada, Indigenous women and girls are 12 times more likely to be murdered or missing than other women in Canada, and 16 times more likely than Caucasian women. A study in 2018 in the U.S. shows that 84% of Indigenous women have experienced violence in their lifetime, a figure much higher than for Caucasian women. The Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit People movement is calling attention to this and the fact that this sexual violence, murders, and missing person cases are rarely given any media attention and not often logged into government statistics or pursued by law enforcement.
You know, it's a hangover of colonialism.
What Priscilla calls a hangover is the intoxication left over from colonial violence that still permeates society today. But steps are being made to decolonize thinking about gender. Previous to colonization, not only did women hold spaces of equal power in many Indigenous societies, but more shades of gender and sexuality were recognized as normal and even special.
It's a non-binary thing because we also have strong, powerful, creative, non-binary folks, you know, Two-Spirit people, the range of gender issues. And we are coming to terms with that in our community now, recognizing the beauty and the powerful leadership that comes out of non-binary communities. And that was really impacted by Christianity in all our communities. And not only Christianity, but fundamentalisms, where these people were seen as bizarre or sinful or whatever adjective they gave to this part of our community. And yet today we are finding that they were our knowledge holders. They were our sages. They were the people who created hope, mischief, fun, deep, deep consciousness about what is good in the world that we see evident today. So we are learning to embrace this aspect of our community.
Just to give you an example of this hangover, I ran into a group of women playing hand drums. They reclaim Ojibwe songs and write some of their own for today's times. They sing to build community and empower women to use their voices and raise awareness about issues that Native women face. They were full of laughter and were also aware of the depth of the work that they do as they sing at community events. Somehow, over the course of colonization and the prohibition of all Native American ceremony, including singing and dancing, drumming became a male thing.
Well, the whole idea of women drumming is radical. And it's radical and threatening to a lot of people in the community, men and women. And so what we try to do is sing these songs in a warm and loving way, and that's the way you heal those kind of rifts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Patriarchy is a heavy, heavy, heavy thing, and it has been adopted by many Indian people because it was pushed on them. And, you know, it entraps you without knowing it. You know, they don't recognize, a lot of men don't recognize how tied up in the patriarchy they are.
Some people find it threatening that we are hand drumming and singing songs and being more inclusive in that process or in that practice because they're, you know, the foundations of colonization are strong throughout. Even in the idea of decolonizing, we have to first know what colonizing is, right? So what does it really mean to decolonize? And how do we move forward in a way that feels like there's cultural integrity there and that we're taking care of each other along the way?
Simone Senegals is our next guest on the episode today. Simone works for the Indigenous Environmental Network and has been organizing a series of webinars on Indigenous feminisms that I highly recommend.
Buju, Chinoden Ikwe Indigenikas, Misquagami Rizaga Ikening and Donjiba, and Migisi Indudame and Bemidjigamaginda. So my name is, in my language, my name is like Big Storm Woman. My other name is Simone Senegals. I'm of the Eagle Clan, and I'm from the Red Lake Nation in northern Minnesota. And I live in Bemidji, Minnesota, which is the first city on the Mississippi River.
So I asked Simone, how did Native cultures begin to accept gender relations based on colonial power structures?
So there's stories that a lot of Indigenous peoples tell about when colonizers first came and wanted to negotiate with tribes or nations, there was different dynamics that happened. Like, so maybe the tribe sent men to negotiate with them. And so then colonizers, one, that already fit within their worldview as men being the ones with power. Two, they perpetuated that, right? Like, so sometimes they wouldn't speak to women. But what they didn't understand was that the women were the ones making the decisions and telling the men to go what to do.
Simone talks about the legacy of colonization like a string all tangled up.
And I always think that the way that colonization has affects Indigenous communities is almost like a big tangle. It's just this big confusion, right? The way that colonization affects our communities and the way that it affects our power structures and the role of women, two-spirit, non-binary people, men, has been distorted because of colonization. So now in this moment, like, we have to pull out a string to talk about that particular dynamic. And feminism is a word that for me is useful in that conversation because it challenges us to like look at that. Like, feminism is a part of colonization in some ways. And the word helps us to think through the effects of colonization on our communities and ourselves. So it's a useful word, even though it's inadequate if we were fully intact. If Indigenous communities were fully intact, we wouldn't need the word feminism, hopefully, or at least within my own community. So we find ourselves in this moment of time where we are trying to reclaim that which is ours, our own way of thinking. And sometimes it requires the use of terms like feminism because it holds so much for us. And some of it is very problematic, but even the things that are problematic within the term feminism help us to tease out that tangle.
But feminism isn't actually a word that is commonly used in the Indigenous food sovereignty movement here in North America. It carries heavy historical and cultural baggage. Many people associate the term with struggles of middle-class white women.
And so I think there's a lot of reasons why people sometimes push back on the word feminism, because it's very much associated with mainstream white feminism in the US, which doesn't translate well or is not applicable necessarily as is to Indigenous struggle, worldview, thought, cosmology. Because I think that like for a lot of Indigenous people, the word feminism, it sort of denotes a separation between genders that doesn't take into account a holistic way of communal being and living and responsibility. It's a binary that's false for many Indigenous communities, or at least it's a binary that assumes that even if there are different like gender roles or roles for people in community, that there is a power differentiation too, right? Because a lot of Indigenous communities do talk about like things like gender roles or the differences between like men and women or different people have different roles in society, but it's not connected for many Indigenous communities to hierarchy or power over. It's more about responsibility and role and being part of a whole community.
Relationships of respect, reciprocity, and responsibility are key to Indigenous cultures. This is true for relationships among humans, but also with non-human relatives. This is where food sovereignty starts to come in. Responsibility, rather than rights, is central.
So Indigenous feminisms, which is within Indigenous thought, there's a high priority on responsibility more than rights. What is our responsibility to ourselves, to each other, to Mother Earth and the coming generations, and even our ancestors? There's just a lot of responsibility because Indigenous worldview is so communal. And so we see ourselves as part of. And so as food sovereignty, we know that for food sovereignty to exist, there has to be intact relationships of respect, you know, reciprocity, responsibility. And so it fits very well within Indigenous worldview and Indigenous feminisms around what is our responsibility to the world and how do we thrive. And in order to thrive, we have to have these relationships. And I think that everyone who knows about food sovereignty, agroecology, knows that it can't work unless there's healthy, respectful, equitable relationships. And that doesn't just mean with each other as humans, but with Mother Earth.
Natural resources, for example, are not considered resources to be used, but rather relatives, beings, gifts that must be taken care of and nurtured. It is a relationship of reciprocity in which humans take care of non-human beings, and they, in turn, take care of humans by providing food, shelter, clothing, and everything humans need.
So, for example, within a worldview such as Indigenous feminisms, an Indigenous worldview that does not embrace the idea that our relatives are resources, or that like our plant relatives are simply resources, but instead we consider our plant relatives to be relatives. So for example, in Ojibwe country, in Anishinaabe society or an Anishinaabe culture, wild rice or manioc is an incredibly important food source.
As for buffalo for the Lakota, wild rice is a relative, a food of great historical, spiritual, and cultural importance for the Anishinaabe people. Before contact with Europeans, and as late as the 20th century, Anishinaabe people depended on wild rice as a crucial part of their diet, together with berries, fish, meat, vegetables, and maple sugar.
We watch the season to see when it's going to be ripe. In the old days, mostly Indigenous women used to go out on the lakes or rivers where wild rice was growing, and they would take their own either like something to tie it with, or they would tie it in a certain way, and they would take the seeds and fold them over and bundle them so that if the wind came, they wouldn't get blown away. And everyone respected each other's space. And women were in control of that, mostly.
Women used to be responsible for stewarding, harvesting, and processing wild rice. But in the early 1900s, men also had lost their place in society after being moved onto reservations. Men began to take over the wild rice harvest when wild rice began to be sold as a commodity and women were displaced. Going out harvesting now is a way of re-establishing relationships with food and with non-human relatives.
And so when we go out and harvest wild rice in that way, we have to be aware of the seasons. We don't determine when we harvest it. It determines when it gets harvested. We leave enough. So we go out on boats, on canoes, and we have a wooden paddle or wooden stick that you push your canoe through the wild rice. And then you have one person who sits with two sticks and you pull it in and you knock it in. So it's all hand harvested and it's all in, like if the rice is ready, it's ready. If it's not, we wait. We don't force it. We don't take too much in this way too. Like a lot of the seeds fall back into the water and regrow. We leave enough for the ducks. We deal with the spiders that live on the water. We do it communally. We do it with understanding and respect about who's, like my family has a place where we've always gone ricing, or where we've gone ricing for a long time. The way that we exercise food sovereignty in accordance with Indigenous feminist views and frameworks is with respect for the seasons, with respect for the plant or animal life that we are asking to give its life so that we can eat. It's in a communal understanding so that we respect each other's boundaries. We give ceremony, we give thanks, we ask permission. And we can't harvest outside of the correct season or anything like that. So we have to do it in a certain way that will ensure the continuation of that food source.
So harvesting respectfully is a way of exercising feminist food sovereignty.
I fell in the water the first time I tried to rice. You know, that's humility. You know, it's really hard physical work. And I didn't have the right balance and I was too anxious to prove myself. And I got an immediate correction from the water and the wild rice. They're like, you need to slow down and you need to like be humble and learn. And if not, you're going to fall in. And I did. And then my ricing partner who was teaching me, we laughed so hard I could barely get out of the water. But it was a beautiful experience. It's fun to do it. When we harvest, it's a whole process. It's hard work, but it's not a chore. And it's putting our theory into practice, putting our worldview into practice, which is one of respect. And it's incredibly satisfying, and it propagates life.
So why is it that Indigenous food stories are so often braided together with memories of violence against women? These are embodied memories. All across the world, colonial policies condoned the destruction of Indigenous peoples' sources of food, as well as violence against Indigenous women. These were tools of conquest that crippled cultures, tore social fabric, and stripped Indigenous peoples of their capacity to be autonomous. This is why Indigenous food sovereignty is inherently a decolonial project of reparations and reconstruction. Strengthening relationships with food and land goes hand in hand with rebuilding places of power for Indigenous women and Two-Spirits. As June said, food is where the healing begins, and our land has all the medicine we need. Undoing the tangle of colonialism, as Simone called it, is not just a job for Indigenous people. It's everyone's job. Recovering from the hangover, as Priscilla described, is not just a task for women. Getting back to that belly button that can lead us to the source of identity is powerful, and everyone, as Lisa reminded us, everyone has that connection. This mini podcast series, A Journey Through Feminist Agroecology, is a collaboration between Agroecology Now at the Center for Agroecology, Water and Resilience at the University of Coventry in the UK, and CITSA, the International Network of Catholic Social Justice Organizations. You can find more information, including references where you can dive deeper into these topics on our websites, agroecologynow.com and CITSA.org. You can find our next episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.